Hello and welcome to episode 25 of the Match of the Week podcast here on the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. I'm Tim, and with me for all 25 episodes has been Tanner. Tanner, congratulations on 25 pieces of podcast audio for the listening public.
I can't believe we've been doing this for 25 years. It's actually a little surreal.
Oh, yeah, that's match of the year, not match of the week.
Oh, 25 weeks. Okay. Yeah, I thought time had passed me real fast. Okay. Yeah. But no, it is really cool that this has went on as long as it has, just because especially in the early days, we were like, oh, we don't even know who's going to host it. And then, you know, we kind of lucked out in that one. And now look at us. We have the Nintendo Switch only podcasting network to thank.
Correct.
And it's a great piece of business. And I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, me too, man. And so one thing we mentioned at the end of our last podcast is we really, you know, have talked about the breadth. Like, we really have tried to really go out and not have the most similar matches possible. I mean, obviously we have our favorites, and you can probably figure that out if you've listened to all the episodes by now. But I mean, we've gone to FMW, WWE, Pro Wrestling Noah, WCW, CMLL, All Japan Women, Ring of Honor, the Indies with Joey Janela Springbake 2, NXT, Mid-Atlantic, ECW, 01, All Japan, the WWE ECW, IWA Mid-South. Like, we have really tried to make this about as much different types of wrestling as possible. And I'm really, and I know you are too, you're very happy with how this has turned out.
Yeah. I'm really happy that we have been able to cover so much, and we're not just, because it would be super easy to come on here and talk about a Noah match every week, but like, I am very happy that we've sort of explored everything that, because I believe is the oldest match we've done. The
Piper Valentine match from
Piper 83. Valentine match.
That's the oldest match we've done.
Okay. So, and that was in 81?
83,
excuse me. So that was in 83, and we've literally covered a match in 2018. So we've covered, you know, matches 35 years apart in different promotions, different continents. So it's I'm really happy the sort of catalog we've built so far in our first 25 episodes.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah. And you know, definitely go online, ProWrestlingOnly.com, click on the podcast tab, and you'll see all those matches that we have covered in our 25 weeks so far right there for the taking. So we hope you enjoy it. And also subscribe to the network on your podcast listening device of choice. So, you know, with number 25, we had to do, I think, a big match. And, you know, this is obviously a big match. It's a very much like our last week's episode, a turning point for a promotion in a lot of ways, and done in a way that sets them up for the biggest run, in a sense, that the company had ever seen at that point. And we're talking about the WrestleMania 13 submission match between Bret Hart and Steve Austin. And it's really interesting, especially now, considering that, you know, quote unquote, the WWE house style has become what it's become. But it is, I think, even more striking now to even be seeing matches from the 90s in this type of atmosphere or in this type of environment compared to what we're seeing today, because this is a completely different match than even maybe something that happens 3 or 4 years later, just because of how the scene evolved. But this is, if it's not the best, it is one of the best brawls that the WWF, WWE, whatever you want to call it, has produced in the TV era.
Oh, yeah. I mean, without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, this, and again, we talked about this. There's actually a lot of similarities, like you mentioned, between this match and the match we covered last week, where this also seems to be sort of that bridge in styles where it really relies on a bunch of late 80s, early 90s tropes, but also helps usher in this like new era of professional wrestling. And it acts as and again, it's something you can't, you know, script. I mean, it just sort of happened naturally. So it is really cool that, And obviously, you know, one really cool moment in a match that's literally nothing but cool moments. That's always something that's kind of stuck with me with this match. And I've seen this match dozens of times at this point. I just think it's really cool how it kind of did the same thing as the Misawa unmasking match did in that sort of sense.
Yeah, and so the backstory for this has been told time and time again, but it has to be reiterated how this was designed as a way to basically put Austin over for good. He had done it at the King of the Ring to get his initial notoriety, and obviously he's talked about it a bunch. Hart's talked about it a bunch, but after the Survivor Series match where, you know, there was all the calling out and Brett comes back after his hiatus and Austin just barely loses by the skin of his teeth, but also shows that he can hang with the best that the WWF has to offer. The next, 5 months really leads up to this moment where, because of the fact that Brett was in his contract negotiations, which of course were well publicized at that time, and was basically feeling like the way he was wrestling wasn't exactly fitting in anymore because of what Austin was doing and what some of the other guys around, the Fed were doing. This was his opportunity, he felt, to make a change, and decided, you know what, I'm gonna become a heel. And I think the subtleties that led up to this, which are basically a year in the making, if you really want to go back to the Michaels match, you could kind of tell this was coming. It really is interesting to think about what led up to this, and then just the explosion for the 7 months after this, because it really did change the face of the company for forever. It really did.
Oh, absolutely. And I do want to mention, I actually pulled up a little article here from Bleacher Report that is kind of like the history of the match. And I just wanted to point out one thing real quick, where the reason the Shawn stuff kind of seems like in the forefront for a lot of this is because the original plan for this WrestleMania was Shawn versus Brett.
Right.
And they kind of,
it was the rematch essentially from WrestleMania 12.
Yeah. They wanted to do Shawn versus Brett again. And Shawn, gets the knee injury and quote unquote, and they
lose the smile, all that good stuff. Yeah. Right?
So they go with the Austin match, and again, we talk about companies kind of lucking into things. Good God, talk about a lucking into things here.
Right. And that's the thing, is like, this is the high point of the quote unquote investigative journalism. This is what people remember Dave Meltzer for, was what he did from a reporting standpoint in 1997, like, and Wade Keller and the guys of his ilk. Like, those were the people, Mike Johnson, whoever you want to talk about, like, those were the folks who were basically in the throes with what was going on behind the scenes of this match. Because obviously what happened less than 2 months prior, which led to the Final Four pay-per-view and led to that really odd way of Brett winning the title and then losing to Sid in the cage match on Raw, which becomes the impetus for, Brett's heel turn in a lot of ways. And it really becomes this meta narrative, in a sense, that plays out in real time. It is Brett essentially saying, okay, that's fine. I don't mind being the bad guy. In fact, I'll make the choice. I'll be like, let's go. Turn me heel. Let's make this a full 100% thing instead of a shades of gray thing. And at the same time, because Austin was getting cheered, they might as well turn him face too. And so this double turn that in storyline terms was probably a long time coming, but was also one of those things where I think behind the scenes, they were kind of holding on for what they thought was the right moment. This was the moment.
Yeah.
And then they capitalized on it.
Isn't it funny, but not trying to get away from the match, but isn't it funny that literally the only other time the WWE has successfully done one of these double turns was a Dolph Ziggler versus Alberto Del Rio match?
I don't know how that works. I really don't know how that works.
Like,
it was also the night after WrestleMania, and so that's kind of, that's why that happens. And they just decided to go with Dolph, and for very short amount of time with him having the belt, by the way. That was very much a short-lived title reign.
Yeah, I think he gets concussed. I think he got concussed like after that match with Del Rio, so he had to drop the belt. But just a weird offhand comment that the only other time they were even close to successfully recreating this was with Dolph Ziggler and Alberto Del Rio. I just always find that as a little funny, like, did you know fact. But it is weird to me that, and again, you know, like this again, this is one of those matches where everyone and everybody has seen it, so it's not like, you know, we're not changing the narrative here or anything. But like Austin and Brett have both said they completely called this match in the ring.
Yeah, this was, they knew what the finish was. Yeah. The finish was basically decided beforehand. And I think they knew how they wanted to start it. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, yeah, everything else was very much was on the fly. And yeah.
Even the blood. You can kind
of tell. The blood, yeah. That was not a decision that was made backstage. In fact, that was something that Steve Austin tells a story plenty of times on his podcast about how pissed Vince was when he went backstage and realized how much blood there was.
Yeah. I mean, so it's just like, I couldn't imagine like 10 years from now, us hearing the story about a WrestleMania main event being completely called in the ring. Like that's just not what the company is anymore. Like that just doesn't happen. That you don't go out there, you know, in front of 70,000-80,000 people now at WrestleMania and be like, oh, we're just going to call it on the fly. We're just going to sort of bullshit it.
Yeah, there's only a couple of guys who could probably even get away with that now.
Oh, yeah. Know? Like, I don't even know if any full-timer could get away with it. So,
right. About saying, I don't know. I don't know who the guy is.
I was going to say John, but John's not a full-timer anymore. So,
nope. So, but yeah, like, I think one of the things that I always pride myself in is when there's an actual hate-filled feud that has a blow-off match that starts off like it is a hate-filled feud.
Yeah.
Like, the opening 5 minutes of this are just nothing but just ridiculously intense brawling. And in a match like this, with what has led up to it, the history that the guys have built up over the previous 6 months, like, that's expected. And I know a lot of people are like, you don't need to throw out there what's expected, but it's like, they're here to watch them kick the living shit out of each other. Let them do that. Let them do that for sure. Yeah. And yeah, like, it turns into just this really, it's an elaborate brawl because of the stipulation. Like, the first few minutes of it really, you know, really, I think, paint the picture that these guys hate each other. But then when the submission stuff starts becoming a part of it, that's when it really kicks into another gear that really you had never seen in a match like that in the history of the WWF up to that point.
Yeah, and a cool thing with the submissions here, and is like, the submissions aren't like their rest spots. Like, they're still like writhing in pain. Like, the crowd is just, I mean, eating out of the palm of these guys' hands. Like, talk about one of like the all-time like best crowd reactions to a match. Yeah,
it's the Rosemont Horizon in Chicago. Like, this is, you know, this is the state. This is the spot that, Austin says is his favorite place to be. Like, he loves that more than any place else because of the acoustics and everything else. And you can hear it.
Yeah, that carries over on tape.
The badly mic'd WWF crowds of 1997. You can hear just how just absolutely apeshit they go for this match.
Yeah, and they're actively looking like they're trying to get out of the hold. As weird as that sounds, like, of course they are, but like, you don't see that in a lot of wrestling nowadays. Not just in WWE. Like, there's a lot of times where a guy will just sit on a clover leaf for 2 minutes. But
sure.
Now you like here they're like actively trying to fight it off and kick it off instead of just, you know, sitting there and screaming. And it really does add that sort of like hate filled, you know, legitimacy of the match. And we should also talk about Ken Shamrock being involved as well.
Yeah. So Shamrock is the special guest referee. This was right before he gets brought in full time. Mm-hmm. Vince had always had kind of this thing for the UFC about like how he'd like to intermingle with them, you know, Severn and eventually Blackman and those guys coming in. But this was a high profile get in 97. Shamrock, the World Dangerous Man, the UFC had been a pay-per-view, you know, semi-phenomenon to that point. It was definitely well talked about. It was very controversial. Ken obviously had a background in pro wrestling with his time in Japan for Fujiwara's promotion, PWFG. And so he was aware of what was going on. He knew what it took to be a part of this. And I think what was really interesting about this is for the entirety of the match, really, he plays it like a just straight up referee, and he does a really good job of it. He does a great job of it, actually, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, like he plays a really good, like, I mean, like he does his job as a ref, but it's also like he's kind of like the enforcer, like, whoa, bud, like, you know, like he's there to make sure they act. It feels weird talking about this from like a real standpoint, but he's there to make sure that essentially they don't do anything too screwy. But he's going to be like, okay, I understand that these guys hate each other. I'm going to let them kick their ass. I'm just here in case it gets out of hand, because it will take someone like me to break these two people up. So, and I really like the added, like, oh, he's from the UFC. There are no rules in the UFC. And I kind of love that sort of dynamic. Like, again, something that couldn't happen in WWE today and probably wrestling as a whole today. Like, I really appreciated the fact that they went that extra step and bought in someone like Shamrock for the job.
And the story they tell in this match, I think, is really cool, how they interweave so many different things that had happened the 6 months prior, and even more so before that. You know, you have the idea that, you know, Brett wasn't going to use the chair at first. It was Austin who decided to use it. But then when the opportunity presented itself, Brett used it in a way to go right after the leg of Austin. And that set the story up basically for the rest of the match. You had the ring post figure four, which was something that Brett had started to use kind of as a way to kind of show that he was going to, you know, not be afraid to bend the rules, which was something that you hadn't really seen from Brett up to that point, but was something he had in his arsenal just in case he needed to. You saw him try to do to Austin the Pillmanizing that Austin had done to Brian Pillman months earlier to play off the shattered ankle that Pillman was coming off of with his motorcycle accident. You really had this really cool dynamic of what Austin, from a submission standpoint, was going to try to do. He wasn't going to use the $1 million dream anymore. He would use this awesome ground octopus hold, which was just still bonkers to see Steve Austin do in 1997.
Yeah, kind of wish he held on to that for like all of his career.
Yeah, like that's it looks quote unquote lazy, but it also is like really nasty looking. Yeah. And Brett basically, he had the side of his head touching his shoulder. Yeah. It was like, it was nasty looking. It was great.
It looks lazy because it literally looks like Austin's just laying there. But for the guy in it, it's like they're all contorted and it looks really cool.
Right. But then that leads to the first, you know, sharpshooter attempt. And Austin fights it off. But eventually he's able to lock it in. And once he locks it in, I thought it was one of the great false finishes. You can't really have a false finish in a submission match, but this is as close as you're going to get, where Austin is in it for like a minute and a half. The blood is pouring down his face. And somehow when Brett's trying to cinch it back in, he's able to get just enough to push Brett back off the hold. But Brett, being Brett, is able to hold on. And then, of course, he is able to get back in position and he wrenches it in. He wrenches it in. It is one of the best sharpshooters he's ever done.
Probably the best 100%. One, honestly.
It probably is. And Austin, I don't know. Like, he also, I think he might have hit his forehead. I don't know if that was planned, but definitely more blood the second time that the hold was put on. And then, of course, he famously passes out and Shamrock calls the match for Hart. I was really, I think, taken aback by the second half of the match, because I hadn't seen this in a really long time. And I'd remember the beginning because it was just this ridiculous brawl. And I obviously remember the finish, but the kind of the middle was fuzzy for me. And I really loved the fact that once Austin and the initial leg attack that Hart was throwing his way, once he went back on offense, he didn't forget. He used the stunner as a transition move into his submission mm-hmm. time where he was trying to wear down Brett. And I thought that it really was a brilliant way to kind of bridge the way that you would normally tell a match between these two and really put the stipulation over, because I really enjoyed the middle part of this match, I think, a lot more than I remember watching it
back. Oh yeah. Like, I mean, obviously for this match, which is, I dare say, probably like the most iconic match in WWE canon, but results may vary there. But it's definitely a match built on moments, but there's not as much in the middle, but the middle is still, I mean, awesome. Like, I mean, this match is legitimately top five match in company history in my right. eyes. So, it's just awesome. Like, through and through. Again, you have all the story leading up to it. And like, I always love the fact that, again, it wasn't the original plan. Like, what in wrestling do we see is the original plan, but it's really cool to think like, well, what happens if we do get Shawn versus Brett here? Like, again, that's something like, then you probably don't get Survivor Series, which probably means you don't get the Montreal Screwjob, which means, you know, all of this, like, maybe it's more of a, right. It really is insane how, again, one move in a promotion's history leads off, I mean, the most rating wise successful era of the WWE, WWF, obviously yeah. not making near as much money as they do now, but you know, what can you do?
Well, we had talked about which of the two Austin Brett matches do we want to do, and we settled on this one. And you know, the first one in 96 at the Survivor Series, I think a lot of people have pegged as one of the, if not the best WWF matches ever. Like, from a straight wrestling match perspective, there are very few matches that touch that. Like, it is one of the most well-worked matches ever. It is in front of Madison Square Garden. Those guys know both these guys very well. They lay it out in a way that is just absolutely superb. And then you take a look at this match, and you really could have had a more opposite stylistic match. But it is amazing how these two had this dynamic, just this really for a short time. Remember, they really only were across from each other for about a year until Austin gets hurt by the Owen Piledriver at SummerSlam 97. Then by the time Austin's ready to come back, you know, Brett had the Montreal Screwjob. And so you really only had essentially 9 months for these guys to be across from each other. But man, it is probably the most effective use of 9 months in-ring to in-ring that you'll see in the history of wrestling. Very few feuds do in 9 months what these guys do.
No, I completely 100% agree with that. It almost makes you wonder what would happen. I mean, again, it's a thing like, what if Austin doesn't get injured? What if Brett doesn't leave? Like, is this like the defining feud of the Attitude Era? And that makes you think, like, do we even get a Rock? Like, imagine if Brett is pushed as one of the main stars of the Attitude Era, and they're like, oh, sorry, Rock. Like, that means we don't have a Rock. Like, I can't fathom right. a world without the Rock, you know? Like, it's crazy. And even a guy like, you know, Triple H would have probably got, you know, left behind for at least a couple more years. It is one, like, something to look at that. Yeah. But what they do with the time they get, you know, the 9 months that they get is really, I mean, just superb from like every aspect. I mean, literally not a wrong step in the whole process.
So yeah, like it's pretty much apparent that this match, And it's been said as much, I think, is a turning point for how the WWF viewed itself going forward. Obviously, this was the match that made Austin the guy, and they strapped him up next, the next WrestleMania against Michaels, who was on his way out because of his back injury. And, obviously that led to more. But I think the other thing that I come away with from this match is that I don't know if you could do a quote unquote. So there's I Quit. There's the street fights. There's Last Man Standing, which has kind of become the style of this match that WWE has adopted. But remember, submission matches, they used to become a thing when He Who Shall Not Be Named and Jericho and Guerrero and those guys and were facing more of each other. And I am interested to think, if this submission match stip, when's it going to get used again? It really hasn't been used all that often in about a decade, even more so. And it is a really unique way to either get a new hold over or get somebody in a position where they have to be put at a disadvantage and see how they, how they fight out of it. And I really wish this was the type of stipulation from an in-ring perspective that was used more often, because I think it adds to a match that very few other stipulations do, especially considering others I think have been overused.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, when was the last time a submissions match was used for a big match? And I'm drawing a blank. I'm sure probably during Brian, I want to say Brian had one during his US title reign, but again,
there was a Brian Miz submission match.
But again, that would have been 8 years ago, 9 years ago. So,
right. Yeah, this was when right after he had beat him for the U.S. title.
So, you're right. It's been nearly a decade. And WWE did have that really good pay-per-view. I think they ran twice, called Breaking Point, which actually had one of the matches I remember from it was a submissions count anywhere match between Cody Rhodes and Ted DiBiase Jr. versus DX. That was way better than it had any right to be. And that was probably the last time I remember a submissions match being used in sort of a big setting, because obviously it was two younger guys versus two older guys. So it was a kind of a big thing. And it seems I wonder if it's just because they realize they don't have a lot of guys that really rely on submissions anymore. So, they do, but they never match them up with each other for some reason. So I don't really know, because it seems because you're right now, the de facto big feud ender match is a Last Man Standing. If somebody's in a feud, it's going to be regular match, Last Man Standing, 3 pay-per-view formula. There's never a submissions or anything else thrown in there. It really, any of these endurance, except Last Man Standing, we never really see Iron Man's anymore. I say that, we had one this year, but we did, it's seldom used. So it seems weird that they kind of rely on the classics, a steel cage or a Last Man Standing, and don't really come back to these, different match types, a submissions match.
And so that's kind of the thing. It's and the reason I bring it up is because I do feel like it is in the right situation. Becky Lynch and Charlotte, I think a submission match between the two of them would be really fun, because, the disarm her and the figure eight, I think that would be a great way for that feud to end if they decide to go that route at some point.
Yeah.
There's definitely ways you can do it. I just kind of wonder what that looks like and who would think about it, and is it, how it would be booked into it, because there are definitely ways it could be done. And I just think it's one of my stips that I really enjoy. A lot of it because it hasn't been used as much, but also it's one of those things where I'd love to see more matches that have a specific goal that needs to be done, other than knock your guy out for a 10 count or climb out of a cage or whatever, it is. So I do think you can't get to that point. Even Hell in a Cell, Hell in a Cell has been basically devalued essentially almost entirely in the last.
Yeah, do you remember when Hell in a Cell matches were numbered?
Yeah.
Now, imagine if they did that now. What, they ran 4 last year?
Right.
Or 4. They've ran 10 in the last 3 years.
Yeah, it's been insane. It really has been. And there's been good matches. There've been good matches.
Yeah, and some of them have been good. It's just one. It's just like it's basically a souped up steel cage match now.
Yeah.
Like it's not like the career threatening. The like I guess the last real like career threatening Hell in a Cell match in this whole other tangent was Undertaker Edge SummerSlam 2008, which we may talk about one day because I love that match and I adore that match. But
that's got one of the crazier finishes that is one of the more creative finishes that's ever done in a WWE match too. So it's an interesting stip, and you know I do wish it was used more, and wish that those types of stipulations were just a little bit more leaned upon than they have been, because I really do think that there's situations where it'd be fun. It really would add something to a feud and a feud.
Absolutely.
Well, so
absolutely.
You can find this match on the award-winning World Wrestling Federation Network, WrestleMania 13, obviously the pay-per-view. Great call by Vince and JR and Jerry Lawler here. Really put JR. This is kind of, I think this is one of the standout JR performances. I think he really puts over just the importance of everything that happens in this match in a way that really he was very, very good. This was outside of WCW, but still Jim Ross in that peak Jim Ross form where he knew how to really put something over. And so very, very much a great performance by him in the broadcasting department for sure.
Yep, absolutely.
So listen to this, all the other fine podcasts on the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Go to ProWrestlingOnly.com. Check out all our 25 podcasts on the podcast tab. Click on Match of the Week. You'll get to hear about some of the things that we've talked about in the past, including the PCO versus Walter Joey Janela Spring Break match that was recently mentioned in Kenny Johnson's PCO doc. Thank you to Kenny for that. But also we got some classics on there like Eddie Guerrero versus Brock Lesnar, Vader versus Cactus Jack from Halloween Havoc 93, Hokuto Kendori from Dream Slam 1. We talked about Gargano Ciampa from NXT TakeOver New Orleans, the great Kobashi Takayama Noah GHC Heavyweight Championship match, all types of stuff. Go listen to it. It's great content. And subscribe to the podcast network, and you can get these every week in your podcast feed of choice. So, Tanner, where can folks find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Tanner1495. I also co-host another podcast with my friends called the All You Can Hear Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at AYCH Podcast and listen to us on SoundCloud, iTunes, and Google Play Music. We actually just released our 77th episode, and then we have a couple of non-canon files in there. So there's plenty of stuff for you. Go through all these, go over to AYCH, listen to some non-wrestling talk for a little bit. I think it's a good time.
Did you talk about Five Guys on the most recent podcast?
On the most recent one, no, but I bring it up a lot.
Cajun fries. But yeah, you can follow me at Mr. Tim Livingston and also follow at PPW Petaluma. We have our 4th anniversary show coming up at the Phoenix Theater in Petaluma, California, in the North Bay of the San Francisco Bay Area on Friday, November the 16th. Tickets available on our Facebook page with the ticket link there for the event. And so check that out. You can also buy them at the door. But come out. It's our 4th anniversary show. It should be a lot of fun. There's going to be a battle royal. It'll be a championship match with Boyz II Grand. Come on out. It'll be fun. And kids get a discounted rate too. So if you got kids who want to come out and watch the professional wrestling, family-friendly event, you should have some fun and bring them out too. So Tanner, 25 officially in the books. We have done it.
Yep, our 25 years, and here's to another 25 more.
Hopefully we age gracefully going forward.
I hope so.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in for this and the last 25 in total. And we look forward to the next 25 and then some here on the Match of the Week podcast on the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Take care.
Ciao.